Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We've all heard this story before. The U.S. threatens economic sanctions against Iran. Iran threatens to cut off the flow of oil. What's different this time? The sanctions might actually work. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us for the Marketplace podcast on this Wednesday. It is the 28th of December, a day on which, as usual, about a dozen oil tankers carrying about 15 million barrels of crude through the Strait of Hormuz. That's the narrow passageway ships have to go through to get from the Persian Gulf out into the Indian Ocean. And it has become the center of a dispute between Iran and the United States. Iran is threatening to shut down the passageway if the U.S. goes ahead with a new round of tough economic sanctions. For more, we're joined by Mohsen Milani. He chairs the Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida. Professor Milani, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Why are these sanctions so much worse in the eyes of Iran than the sanctions that they've lived with for years?
The sanctions that they have lived under for the past three decades are fundamentally different than the possibility of imposing sanctions against Iran's central bank and against Iran's oil and gas industry. If they are implemented, I think this would be considered by Tehran, and they have declared so publicly, nothing short of declaration of economic war against the Islamic Republic, because Iran has an oil-addicted economy and an oil-addicted state. And should there be crippling sanctions against Iranian oil industry, that means Iranian economy will suffer severely, and also the Iranian state would be deprived of at least one half of its annual revenue.
So you're saying that so far the sanctions that have already been put on Iran have been targeted so as not to touch the oil industry, but these ones would?
Absolutely. And I think they would be much more severe, much more crippling. And psychologically, I think it's going to be devastating for the Islamic Republic and devastating for most Iranians that rely on oil revenue.
Explain the state of Iran's economy right now. How are things going?
Well, as a result of the threat of a new round of sanctions, rial, the Iranian currency, was at the lowest ever against American dollar in the past two or three days. And the Iranian economy is not doing very well. There is corruption at all levels of the government. And I think even if Iran has received quite a bit of oil revenues in the past 8 years, that has not translated into a higher standard of living for most of Iranians.
Well, let's talk about this threat to close the Strait of Hormuz. What kind of an effect would that have here in the United States?
Whether it is a bluff or not, I think what Iran is trying to achieve is to cause an increase in the price of oil as a warning to the Europeans that if you join the United States and impose economic sanctions on our oil and gas industry, we will retaliate and then you will suffer because the price of oil will increase substantially. I think Iran also wants to send a clear signal to the Persian Gulf countries that if they participate in this economic sanction, they will pay the price.
Mohsen Milani chairs the Department of Government and International Affairs at the University of South Florida. Professor Milani, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, here in this country, one of the biggest natural disasters of the year still hasn't come to an end. That would be the drought in Texas, which has devastated the state's farmers. But the fallout from that drought extends far beyond the borders of the Lone Star State. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
If you take the 500-mile drive from Austin to Amarillo, every other tree is dead and every farmer's lake is bone dry. Jack Plunkett runs a market research firm in Houston.
I think you really can't appreciate how bad this has been until you get out there and see it.
Ranchers have lost at least 600,000 cows so far. They slaughtered older cows when the drought hit. Now they've cut into breeding stock. And Texas is so big, it's not like other states can just pick up the slack.
This business isn't going to move to Nebraska just because it's been dry in Texas. It's not going to work that way.
Plunkett says it'll take years for Texas grass to grow back enough to feed cattle. He expects steak prices to beef up by the end of 2012. As for the other pillar of Texas agriculture,
the largest contiguous cotton patch in the entire world.
Cotton analyst Mike Stevens says half the farmers abandoned their crops last summer. Most got paid thanks to crop insurance. And frankly, the world hasn't missed Texas cotton.
You had China, you had Pakistan, you had India, and everyone else with bumper crops.
Such good crops that cotton prices sank. Texas farmers are now deciding whether to bother with cotton next year. The Texas state climatologist expects this drought to go into 2012 and higher risk for drought overall due to rising temperatures. I'm Eve Tro from Marketplace.
New York City released a report this week which found that ever since the city implemented its smoking ban in 2002, the number of deaths from heart disease has dropped by 28%. Cities and states around the country have implemented similar bans on smoking in public places, but they've also been trying to reduce smoking by raising taxes on cigarettes. That way, more people quit smoking and the government gets more money. But this year, a funny thing happened. States didn't raise their cigarette taxes very much, and they slashed the funds they used to help people quit. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner reports.
So let's do the numbers. The tobacco numbers. States will rake in $25 billion this year from tobacco taxes and tobacco settlement money. But states will spend less than 2 cents on the dollar toward programs that help people quit smoking.
They haven't invested the money that they're getting to fund these prevention and cessation programs.
Dan Cronin at the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids has released a map of state spending on prevention. No surprise here, rich states like Alaska and North Dakota are spending money at the recommended level, 10 cents on the dollar.
And you have a number of states like Connecticut, Ohio, Nevada, New Hampshire that aren't spending any money at all. They haven't budgeted anything.
Cheryl Heelton of the American Legacy Foundation says this is short-sighted at best.
For every dollar that a state spends controlling the tobacco epidemic in their state, they reap at a minimum $5 in return.
Mostly in preventing premature births and chronic asthma, which drive up healthcare costs. So why did states cut by one-third their budgets for prevention programs? Heelton says there's a growing conflict of interest. States depend on the money they're making from tobacco taxes to plug holes in the deficit.
Their fear is a short-term loss of revenue, but what they're producing for their state is a long-term budgetary crisis related to the health care costs associated with smoking.
Those costs, she says, fall primarily on low-income Americans, who are the majority of smokers in this country. 70% of people try to quit every year. 5% succeed. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Not a lot of success on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. You know that feeling when you're at a restaurant and you're done with your meal and then the bill comes and it's way more than you thought? That pretty much sums up the shock that hit global stock markets today when traders heard just how much money European banks are storing at the European Central Bank these days, a record $452 billion. Storing money at the central bank is pretty much like putting money in a mattress. It means as we close out 2011, banks are still very scared about the state of the economy, just as they were at the beginning of the year. Joining us now to recap the world of banking in 2011 is our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Jeremy.
Well, let's start with the thing that impacts all of us consumers in this country when it comes to the banks, and that is fees. This was a year in which many of the big banks decided they wanted to try to shake a few more coins out of each of our pockets.
That's exactly right. And we've seen amazing stories of fees. I was just reading a story of a boy who had $5 in his checking account and ended up with $229 in fees on it because of overdrafts. We've seen the ingeniousness of banks and how they structure derivatives, and now we're seeing it in how they slip fees past us. What's interesting, though, is that you've seen an outcry, right? Not just the Occupy Wall Street movement, but actual consumers went to their banks and said, we don't like these fees, and they managed to stop them. So this is, I think, a good trend because banks are going to keep imposing fees. Their problem is their profits are falling from consumers. It's very hard for them to make money in that business, especially because of regulation. So they are going to keep imposing fees, and they're probably going to be a little bit more subtle about it. But now we know that consumers are paying attention. So maybe they won't get away with all of it, and we can start questioning the premises of why it is that we're paying money to have them hold our money.
Well, you mentioned regulation. I want to talk about that because obviously this was the year that the big Dodd-Frank financial reform bill was supposed to be implemented. How are we doing on that front?
So Dodd-Frank was about 900 pages long. But in those 900 pages, it was basically a to-do list, right? Nothing was actually set out as the rules. It was, we'll figure this out in 2010, we'll figure this out in 2011. And so here we are. Nothing has really changed in terms of regulation. You hear a lot of talk about it. Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has not yet gotten off the ground. We had something called the Volcker Rule, which was supposed to prevent banks from taking too much risk with their own money.
Right.
We still don't know what that looks like. It creates a lot of uncertainty, and it doesn't help that both Dodd and Frank are leaving Congress, right? So Dodd already left.
They're on their way out.
Exactly. Dodd already left, and Frank is going.
What about the big story that's been really shaking the markets over the last many, many months, and that is the European debt crisis? That's had a big impact on the bottom lines of Wall Street banks.
It has. But the truth is, if you're asking, can banks survive a European debt crisis? What you're really asking is, can they survive a worldwide financial crisis? And they cannot, because if the euro breaks up in an ugly way as opposed to an orderly way, companies will stay away from the markets, traders will stay away from the markets, and no bank can tell you that it can survive that.
All right. Well, let's bring it back stateside. Finally, I want to ask about something that has really been the issue in this country for the last few years, ever since the financial crisis in 08. And that is, when are the banks going to start lending again to small businesses and to consumers?
Yeah. Well, consumers shouldn't hold their breath. It's almost like something from Greek mythology, these incredibly low mortgage rates, and yet nobody can get a mortgage. But if you're a small business or a medium-sized business, chances are you've seen banks become a little bit more cooperative in the past 6 months. We've seen a big boost in bank lending to businesses. They call those commercial and industrial loans, and we've seen them from almost every bank. And that's a good sign, because if the banks are lending to those businesses, then those businesses are borrowing to grow. And if they're growing, they might hire. And if they hire, we might finally be putting a dent in the unemployment crisis.
Wouldn't that be a nice change for 2012? Marketplace New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore, thanks so much and Happy New Year.
Thank you. You too.
So in addition to banking fees, 2011 brought us some new things to talk about. The debt ceiling, credit downgrades, the Kardashians. So what will 2012 bring, other than hopefully less about all three of those things? Well, Robert Reich has a prediction for a commentary series we're calling What Now?
The defining political issue in 2012 won't be the size of government. It's who government is for. Nearly 80% of respondents in a recent Pew Foundation poll said too much power is in the hands of a few rich people and corporations. After all, Wall Street got bailed out, but homeowners caught in the fierce downdraft caused by the street's excesses have got almost nothing. Big agribusiness continues to rake in billions in price supports. Big pharma gets extended patent protection that drives up everyone's drug prices. Big oil gets its own federal subsidy. But small businesses on Main Street are barely making it. And American Airlines uses bankruptcy to ward off debtors and renegotiate labor contracts, but the law won't allow you to use personal bankruptcy to renegotiate your home mortgage. Not a day goes by without Republicans decrying the federal budget deficit. But the cost of one of the deficit's biggest drivers, Medicare, would be lower if Medicare could use its bargaining leverage to get drug companies to reduce their prices. Big Pharma won't allow it. The other big budgetary expense is national defense. The basic defense budget, unrelated to the cost of fighting wars, is now about 25% higher than it was a decade ago, adjusted for inflation. We can't even cancel obsolete weapon systems. Could this be because defense contractors have carefully cultivated sponsors on Capitol Hill and located their plants and facilities in politically important congressional districts? Big government, in other words, isn't the problem. The problem is the big money that's taking over government. We need real campaign finance reform and a constitutional amendment reversing the Supreme Court's bizarre rulings that under the First Amendment, money is speech and corporations are people. We've got to get big money out of politics if we want to get our democracy back.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. His most recent book is called Aftershock: The Next Economy and America's Future. We'd love to hear your thoughts. Just go to marketplace.org and click on contact. Coming up, singing the D.C. blues.
There's the world on Main Street that says, we want to recover. But right when they say we're ready to open our wallet, somebody from Washington with the gridlock and all snuffs it out.
A chat with the mayor of Memphis, Tennessee. But first, let's do the numbers. Today, the Dow Jones Industrials fell 139 points, 1.1% to close at 12,151. The Nasdaq lost 35 points, about 1.3%, ending at 2589. And with just a couple of trading days to go, the S&P 500 gave back its meager gains for the year, declining 15 points, 1.25% to finish at 1249. Gold also fell by more than $31 an ounce, its biggest drop in 2 weeks. It is down to $1,562 an ounce. Bond prices bounced today, lowering the yield on the 10-year T-note to 1.92%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The National Association of Realtors issues its monthly pending home sales index. How crowded are we going to be next year? The Census Bureau is scheduled to release its annual projection of the nation's population for January 1, 2012. And on December 29, 1845, Texas was admitted to the Union. The Lone Star State was the 28th to join. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Jeremy Hobson in for Kai Rizdal. Poland announced today that it is giving almost $8 billion to the International Monetary Fund. How, you ask, does a European country have that kind of money right now? Well, Poland has had a growing economy throughout the debt crisis. And in the interest of maintaining that growth, the country is trying to establish itself as a front door for Chinese companies doing business in Europe. Christopher Wirth reports.
This is GD Poland, a sprawling wholesale market just outside Warsaw. It offers all things made in China. There are about 700 companies here, many of them Chinese-owned. They sell everything from blue jeans to toy Santa dolls that glow in the dark. The center's manager, Felix Wang, says this is the largest market for Chinese goods in the whole of Europe, and buyers come from all over the continent.
Where there's demand, there's a need for supply. The Chinese are starting to invest in Poland, and from what I see, the prospects are huge.
Huge because decades after Poland broke with communism, the country is still hungry for outside investment. It's still selling off state-owned industries. And it's building new roads and other infrastructure as it catches up with Western Europe. So far, much of that outside investment has come from the U.S. and European Union. But Piotr Grodzian of Poland's Foreign Investment Agency says that's changing.
Right now, the biggest number of projects that we have are from the United States. But recently, we observe a huge interest from China.
Chinese firms are bidding to build everything from subways to coal-fired power stations. This month, China's largest maker of construction equipment, Lugong Machinery, is working on a $76 million deal to buy one of Poland's biggest manufacturers. Radek Piffel is with the Poland Asia Research Center in Warsaw.
For Chinese companies, if you invest in Poland, you've got access to EU market. That's a huge market, right? It's Germany, France. You can set up the production here, and you can export your products everywhere in the Europe.
That is, if you can meet the EU's tough standards. In the city of Lublin, Gregor Dobrzynski shows me around a showroom full of shiny new Grand Tiger pickup trucks made by the Chinese car maker ZX Auto.
Have a look at this one. They are ready for delivery to our dealers.
Dobrzynski is with Polmont Warfama, a Polish company that's partnered with ZX Auto to produce the Grand Tiger in Poland. And as he starts one, he ticks off a long list of hurdles, like coming up with a new engine.
The original engines were not very useful because Chinese manufacturer does not comply with European regulations.
But he says the investment will pay off for ZX Auto.
They will be able to sell these vehicles not only in Poland or Europe, but in other countries, even United States.
But not every deal here ends in a win-win. In 2009, the Polish government hired a Chinese state-owned construction company called Kovec to build a new highway. Kovec stopped paying contractors. So earlier this year, the Polish government fired the company. Now it's looking to China to cover the losses. In Warsaw, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
I remember the exact moment when I realized just how bad the Great Recession was and how much of an impact the things that happened on Wall Street and in Washington can have clear across the country. I was driving through Memphis, Tennessee on a reporting trip in the summer of 2010. I got to a neighborhood where just about every other house was abandoned. Many of the former homeowners had been persuaded to take risky subprime loans that they couldn't afford. And when the interest rate skyrocketed, well, you know how the story goes. Now, a year and a half later, to get a sense of how things are going in Memphis, we're joined by the mayor of Memphis, A.C. Wharton. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, the last time we talked back over the summer, I asked you about how Memphis was doing then, and we're going to play you a clip now from that answer.
All in all, I would say that in the not-too-distant future, you're going to see a pretty good turnaround.
A turnaround. So is that happening?
Yes. We're continuing to bring in jobs. We made some progress on pension reform, which you know the failure to reform pensions has gotten places across the nation in trouble. So
right.
That's progress there. We have a reserve, a rainy day fund. It's up to $80 plus million. So, yes, there is a turnaround. But we're not out of the woods by any means.
What about on the foreclosure front? Memphis has been an area that's been hit extremely hard. I saw the latest report shows that the Memphis area saw a big drop in foreclosures from a year ago. Is that good news, or is it just that every house that could possibly be foreclosed on has been?
I think it may be the latter. I think it has bottomed out. But if it has bottomed out, then that's good news. It can't get any worse, and we're seeing some uptick in building permits. I think that may be a positive sign, such as it is, meaning you've hit bottom and you have no place to go but up.
Now, it's been a year in which Washington has been in the news quite frequently and usually not in the best light. A lot of bickering going on back and forth. Both sides can't agree on what to do. How is that impacting you as the year comes to a close in Memphis?
In so many ways. There's just so much gloom and doom coming out of Washington. Back at home, there are folks lined up outside my door every day saying, we want to partner with the city. We'd like to do this. It's as if we're living in two worlds. There's the world on Main Street that says, we want to recover. We're willing to put out some capital to venture into this. But right when they say we're ready to open our wallet, somebody from Washington with the gridlock and all snuffs it out. They throw a wet blanket on it. That's been one of the most frustrating things. The gridlock in Washington is just sucking all the life out of our local economies, particularly when it comes to local government.
Well, what's the difference? What are you doing right that they're not doing?
We know that we are the government of last resort. I think it is unpardonable that Washington is in a position of saying, look, even if we don't get it done, they'll make do somehow. We don't have that luxury at the local level. If I don't provide police services, I cannot say they'll defend themselves somehow. I think maybe Washington ought to have to travel around and hold sessions in the various cities every once in a while and act like they are the government of last resort. I think that's what's missing. There are no sick people knocking on their door, or they don't look out the Capitol windows and see buildings burning because there are no fire crews around. A lot of this is just too abstract for them, and I think that's probably what happens.
A.C. Wharton is the mayor of Memphis, Tennessee. Mayor Wharton, it's a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for taking time to let me share a few views on what we're doing here.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today from North Korea, where a black hearse carried the departed dear leader Kim Jong-il through the streets of Pyongyang to his grave today. The hearse that carried him was actually a 35-year-old Michigan-made Lincoln Continental. An interesting choice given the state of U.S.-North Korean relations. Also worth noting, it appears North Korean state television didn't have enough cameras to cover the entire funeral procession. After about 20 minutes, the channel cut to interviews with mourners, then came back with more of the procession. Though one observer said the light in the sky got brighter on TV as evening approached outside, suggesting the shots were probably not live. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 139 points, 1.1%. The Nasdaq declined 35 points, 1.3%. And the S&P 500 lost 15 points, 1.25%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And next time back here, religious leaders fighting poverty and injustice got some unexpected help this past year.
Occupy has done a job that we have been unable to do, which is capture the public's attention and imagination.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.